Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:05 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 9th, and it's Good Thursday. The UK markets are shut on Friday and Monday, so I'm doing the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes today. And comment of the day and the subscribers' audio and video will next be updated on Tuesday. When we look at what's going on in the world today, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's and it's difficult to come up with a long-term theme or a long-term idea that one could hang your hat on and say, well, this is certainly going to happen. Because I think this was a very good point that Ian Little made in his report earlier on this week, is that a lot of the bases upon which decisions are made in the investment world, whether that is about the discount rate, which where we now have interest rates at zero, whether it's about future earnings, where we don't know how long the lockdowns are going to last, although we can make some guesses as to when they might end, but we don't have concrete examples to point to historically to support any real view. And then additionally, we have no idea what the businesses of companies are going to be like, and the size of economic growth could be there's an enormous spread on any of those types of prognostications. So that makes it difficult to come up with a fundamental value. But I'm reminded of everything that David has said in the past, which, and the first was always that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. And monetary policy is exploding with new measures, and we're getting them on almost a daily basis. And just today, the Federal Reserve announced that they're going to spend an additional $2 trillion on buying high-yield bonds, corporate bonds, municipal bonds. They're extending that assistance not only to states, but also to counties and cities. And that is going to plug an enormous hole in the municipal market. So that's obviously supportive. What, of course, investors should be reminding themselves of is that the only reason that they would go to these additional measures is because of the dislocations in the market, because the buck has to stop somewhere, and ultimately that buck is going to eventually stop with the central bank, and that they have a clear incentive to take out the middleman to the greatest extent possible and to lend assistance to as many different areas of the economy as they can come up and think about. But ultimately, if we have to make one long-term prognostication that has got some basis in potential fact, it's that you can't print that much money and expect the purchasing power of that money to hold its value. That at least makes empirical sense, and it gets to the very heart of what's going on. So when we look at the dollar index, it peaked in 1985, right ahead of the Plaza Accord, which was expressly aimed at devaluing the currency. And that was particularly against the yen, and the yen soared in value, contributed to the massive bubble we had in Japanese equities at the time. And that was one of the best examples historically, that investors like to have both the currency and the central bank on their sides. Then we had another example of that when the dollar peaked in the early 2000s. That was one of the few times in the last 100 years that the federal government has run a surplus, and it was at the top of the internet bubble, and also a time when the dollar had been among the strongest currencies in the world. So again, international investors had the currency and the stock market on their side, And then, of course, they had the yield. Well, we don't have yields right now. But today, Wall Street has been the best performing stock market. And it's also been the home of the best performing sector, which is technology. And the dollar has been among the strongest currencies in the world. And now we're at a point where the Federal Reserve is printing money at a rate that is multiples more than other central banks. So, considering the fact that we have lower rally highs on the dollar index, and the dollar index is now back below that psychological 100 level, it has been ranging below 100 for the last 4 to 5 years and has been subject to a great deal of volatility over the course of the last 6 weeks. We know why some of that has occurred, that the big pullback in February was the unwinding of carry trades. The big move upwards in March was because of leveraged trades being unwound and creating an acute desire for dollars. Then, subsequently, the extending of swap lines to central banks and an expanded number of central banks around the world has contributed to an excess of dollars, and we've seen the dollar starting to pull back again. Well, swap lines are one thing, but the Federal Reserve now deciding that they are going to buy. They're going to supply money to the repo market and essentially become the de facto central bank to the entire world. They are now engaging in buying commercial paper, so that is supplying liquidity to the corporate sector and to corporate treasuries. They are buying municipal bonds, which is supporting both the states, cities, and counties of the entire nation. They are buying investment-grade bonds, so they're supporting the better-positioned companies. They are now also going to try and avoid a fallen angels problem, which has been something that bond investors have been highlighting repeatedly for most of the last few years. So they are now going to buy the bonds of companies that have been downgraded into junk bond territory to simply ensure that their cost of capital does not rise. So that's lending assistance to companies that are on the cusp of failing. Well, that virtually ensures that there are definitely going to be companies that really should fail and are going to be rescued. And this is a very clear replay of the kind of condition that we saw in 2008 with the rescuing of GM. But now it's a substantially larger number of companies. All of that is being done with money being printed out of nowhere with massive fiscal deficits. And of course, the fiscal deficits themselves don't even begin to. We haven't even begun to talk yet about how much money is being spent in sending checks to upwards of 70% of the population, ensuring that. And the knock-on effect of that is that there are going to be millions of people that make more money from their supplementary employment insurance as a result of this stimulus plan than they made from working. Well, when we then think about what is it that those people are going to do when they go back to work? In fact, with there is the real possibility that people are going to come out of the coronavirus scare in a better position financially than they went into it. Because 70% of all FHA mortgages are with that, sorry. FHA mortgages represent 70% of the total mortgage market. And mortgage holders have been given a free ride in terms of no questions being asked if they cite the coronavirus as a reason for skipping mortgage payments. So, People are not paying their rent and they're not paying their mortgages, but their unemployment insurance is in many cases going to be higher than the amount of money they were making. So there is less money going out and there is more money coming in. That does suggest that when this coronavirus issue ends, people are going to have money to spend. That's one point. There is the additional point that if you are making more from unemployment than you were making in the first place, then how willing are people going to be to go back to low-paying jobs? Are we going to get clear demands for wage growth and for a living wage and for fairness and for everyone to that we're all in this together? Are we going to have these kinds of statements coming up when lockdowns do eventually end? So far, we haven't seen that because people haven't got the money in their bank accounts yet. But when people start to realize that they can make more from being unemployed than they can from working, then that is the kind of thing that is going to start to create inflation. Now, we don't have inflation right now. It's not something anyone is worried about. It's something that we're being told we don't have to worry about. In fact, politicians have been universal all over the world in saying this is not the time to talk about deficits. And 10-year Treasury yields at 70 basis points do not suggest that we need to worry about inflation in the short term. But what we are certainly seeing is that gold is firming, and it is now back in the region of the upper side of its short-term range. When we look at this on a longer time frame, it had this rounding base formation between 2013 and 2019, and then it has completed it. It had a small consolidation. It's now had a larger consolidation. It has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average on three occasions now since early 2019, and this continues to look like a medium-term bull market environment. We may not yet have inflation. There is really no evidence yet of inflationary pressures in the market, but it is not a very large logical leap to think that we're not going to have, or we are going to have inflation. I'm getting myself mixed up with my double negatives. Let's just talk very plainly. We're likely to have inflation starting to rise as we come out of the coronavirus lockdown phase. And it is certainly showing up in gold right now. Now, gold tends to do best when it is appreciating in all currencies, and it has been trending higher in a range of currencies for most of this year. In fact, it has been somewhat retarded in its bull market against the US dollar because the dollar has been comparatively firm. But now gold is pushing on to new highs, for example, in Chinese renminbi. And when we go back and think about that, the peak back in 2011 in the renminbi was around 12,000, that it is rapidly approaching those levels in here right now. And the fact is that what is happening in the USA is being mirrored in the UK. The statements by the Bank of England in here today, where they are going to make an extraordinary amount of money available via the wider ability of the central bank to simply make money available to the government without issuing bonds. This is a very similar condition that they had in 2008 when the Ways and Means Committee was able to draw down upwards of £20 billion without ever having to issue debt. Now, that's the definition of modern monetary theory, that a government can spend without having to issue bonds, that they can simply rely on their central bank to print. Now, what's particularly interesting in the world today is that this was an idea that scandalized investors a year ago. But what we have now, as a result of the coronavirus lockdown and economic hiatus, is that every country is deploying this strategy at the same time. So if every country is doing it, that's putting downward pressure on their respective currencies. It's not showing up in the cross rates between those currencies because they're all engaged in this competitive devaluation. That's why gold, or at least I regard gold as the barometer against which all other currencies are measured. And we're seeing it pushing on to new all-time highs on a closing basis at the end of this week in pounds. But it is rallying in all currencies. And this is, I think, the most important point. When we just simply look at the evidence that we have of a global move in the gold market. Now, this was also an interesting week because we saw a period of illiquidity in the markets where there was this incredible move where London spot and traded at one price and the futures price in New York traded at a $50 premium. That is speaking to illiquidity in the futures market and an absence of market making to ensure that we're seeing liquidity flow through the market. But what it is also telling us is that this is a small market relative to the kinds of moves that we see in the oil market, which is substantially larger, or currencies, bonds, or equities. So there is obviously a clear incentive for investors everywhere to buy gold. There is an incredible momentum move going on right now. Interest rates are falling everywhere. In Poland this year, and this chart is of the price of gold in zlotys, they've moved into negative real interest rates. Well, negative real interest rates is about the clearest incentive to go out and buy gold one might could possibly anticipate. It's this commonality that we see where gold is appreciating in every single currency is the kind of environment where people start to wonder about how to buy gold, how to hold on to it, and is there any possible way to buy it at a discount? Well, one thing that's particularly interesting is that the gold-silver ratio got to an all-time low 3 weeks ago, or I should say gold traded at an all-time high against silver of 110. That's gold priced at 110 times the price of silver. Back at silver's peak in 2011, it was trading at about 30 times the price of silver. So this has been an extraordinary environment where silver prices pulled back in an incredibly dynamic manner, whereas previously on every other occasion the price of silver had got to about 80, and on one occasion more than that it had found support. On this occasion it has exceeded the previous peaks by a substantial margin, but now it's starting to come back down again. Silver prices, in other words, are literally dirt cheap relative to gold. And gold continues to look like it is moving higher. Now, if we go back then and obviously look at silver in other currencies, well, against the US dollar, it has pulled back in a violent manner. But we can also look at this price action over the course of the last 6 years, and this is now looking like a very clear failed break, a failed downside break. The dynamic of the rebound has been almost as large as that of the breakdown. It's increasingly likely that we're going to see it go straight back up and test the upper side of the range, which is around 20. But there is absolutely no reason to believe that we're not going to see it break on the upside. And this continues to look like a very lengthy base formation in US dollars. But when we look at it in other currencies, it hasn't broken on the downside. It has been depressed, though, in a number of currencies. But even, and I think even silver, despite the fact that it has been so incredibly volatile, is breaking out in a number of the weakest currencies in the world. So we definitely have the potential that silver prices are going to start to do better from here. Now, when we then think about what are the other ways that people like to invest in the precious metal markets, gold shares are the number one way used by investors to buy gold at a discount. And gold shares have been also one of the sectors that performed worst during the bear market. They did not keep pace with the gold price in outside of the early stages of the initial bull market in precious metals. And that was because they were spending every additional cent earned on increasing their productive capacity. They borrowed substantially to try and build new mines to replace their exhausted mines from the long bear market. And all that money going to on spending rather than paying back investors robbed investors of the ability to gain leverage to the gold price from the gold miners. And gold miners pulled back in an incredibly dynamic manner just a few weeks ago and have since recouped almost the entire decline. And they are now also coming back into the region of the upper side of this 6-year base formation. And this does look like another failed downside break below the lows of the last few years. The vast majority of gold miners have got all-in sustaining prices below $1,000. And gold itself is trading up towards the $1,700 area right now. When we think about the types of companies that are going to report impressive earnings as we go into the first quarter earnings season, well, it's not beyond the bounds possibility that gold miners are going to be among the best performers with the strongest guidance, because the vast majority of companies are not going to be able to have guidance. When we look at, for example, Starbucks, they reported preliminary earnings yesterday, and their earnings up to the 11th of March, if my memory serves me correctly, were up about 8% year on year. So that was a really strong performance, the best in about 4 years. But they cancelled guidance for the rest of the year, and then also said that they anticipate that they'll be back at full earnings capacity by the third quarter. But they took the opportunity to cancel guidance for the whole year. And I suspect that this is exactly what we're going to see from companies going into earnings. It makes sense. And if we think about, well, what would we do? What would we do if we were sitting in a boardroom and looking to face our investors in just a couple of weeks? Well, the first thing we do is kitchen sink it. We would throw absolutely every potential problem that has arisen and say that that has contributed to our underperformance over the course of the last while, so we're going to write that off. And then we would say, well, things are so bad that we can't possibly come up with a concrete way of thinking about our earnings for the rest of the year. And that way, if things are better than everyone is currently positioned for right now, well, then a CEO can take credit for being a wonderful manager. On the other hand, if they started to come out with a strong opinion on how good their business is going to be, and they're wrong, well, then they're going to be considered fools. So there is absolutely nothing to be gained by trying to be a hero in this kind of environment. Well, what that also means is that while they may have some positive attitudes about what might happen in the third quarter, they still have a great deal of uncertainty. And investors are going to have to start dealing with that uncertainty and express a willingness to look past the first quarter or the second quarter, or maybe even the third quarter, and start thinking about what earnings are going to be like in the fourth quarter and into 2021. But Starbucks has seen that its business in China has recovered, and China has gone through the whole coronavirus roller coaster in approximately 4 months. Well, if the lockdowns started in the Western world sometime around March, and the first deaths from the coronavirus were sometime in February, it means that the lockdowns are probably going to be in place until at least the middle of May. And subsequently, we're likely to see a gradual easing of lockdowns. The way that I think is best to think about this is in that it is a normal recession in reverse. A normal recession is usually that things start to slow down and that one or two sectors tend to underperform first, and that spreads to the wider economy. Then the Federal Reserve, or whatever the central bank is, they decide that then is the time to lend assistance. By the time that assistance hits the economy, the market has bottomed and we're already on the recovery. What we're seeing this time is that everything slowed down or stopped at the same time. Central banks have been very quick to provide assistance. They are pouring money into the black hole of stalled economic activity, and that is in no way inflationary as long as there is no activity, because you can't have inflation without rising velocity of money. So that is obviously going to create a great deal of assistance. It's going to obviously create a real source of moral hazard, because why on earth wouldn't somebody take the money that is being doled out, and especially when you don't have to pay it back? So there's going to be massive demand from businesses for these kinds of assistance. That is obviously going to be something that we need to deal with at some point in the future. Gold is obviously telling us that is one of the things that's going to be a problem in future. Higher taxes at some stage are going to represent a headwind to economic growth. But it is worth reminding ourselves that we are in an election year, and the fourth year of the presidential cycle has generally tended to be a good one. Now, obviously, this massive pullback we've had since the beginning of January is it's going to be a monumental task to turn in a positive performance for the stock market this year. And we are likely to see that some companies are not going to survive, that we are going to have more bankruptcies. But the fact that the Federal Reserve is now buying the bonds of fallen angels means that a lot more companies that would naturally have gone bust are going to survive. So that is a positive development. Now, when we think about the technology sector, it is benefiting from the current environment, and the Nasdaq is now right in the region of its 200-day moving average. It is the most consistent major trend in the world. and therefore it's the last holdout in terms of uptrend consistency. And even then, we've had some significant trend deterioration. Now, I think we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the fact that we have had this extraordinary situation, which does not happen all that often. But it is at least holding the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it is now in the region of the first area of potential resistance, represented by the 200-day moving average. If it can sustain a move up and through the 200-day moving average, then we can conclude we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I think, though, that it's unlikely it's going to go straight back upwards. I think it is more likely we're going to get a period of consolidation, that we'll get some kind of range form above the 1,000-day moving average, and subsequently we'll get higher to lateral ranging, with a sustained move above the trend mean occurring at some point over the next few months. And that's the bull case. The bear case is that it fails. And if it fails in this region, then the area around the lows put in March are going to have to hold. The one confirming piece of evidence to suggest that investors are supportive of the view that some technology companies will do better is the fact that Amazon is back above the psychological 2000 level. And I think I personally will be a lot more comfortable when I've seen it find support above the 2000 area on some weakness. But this is positive action. At Amazon, the cloud computing sector. Well, the cloud computing sector was not immune, and it did pull back, and it is now back in the region of the 200-day moving average, having unwound the oversold condition. So this is the do-or-die moment. But logically, we should anticipate that cloud computing would be doing better when everybody is working from home. And that is, I think, something that is logical. But there is the additional point that small companies, particularly startups, are going to come under a great deal of pressure, that their burn rates are going to accelerate as the lead time to positive cash flows is extended. It means that they're going to need more money from their partner private equity firms. They may yet get it, but one of the reasons why there have been so many startups over the course of the last few years is because the cost of starting a new company has compressed very significantly. And the reason it is compressed is because they've been able to outsource their back ends to companies like Amazon or Google or Microsoft. So the big platform companies are the primary enablers of the startup sector. And if the startup sector runs into financial difficulties, then that does represent something that will sap some of the demand from the big cloud and data companies. The big question is whether the uptick in demand from everywhere else will counterbalance the downtick in demand from the startup sector. That's something that investors are so far willing to give the benefit of the doubt to. So when we look at Amazon, that it can sustain the move above 2000, and Microsoft, it's back above its 200-day moving average, and Google has at least steadied from the psychological $1,000 level, that's all representative of at least some support building coming in right now. And these companies have certainly demonstrated relative strength. The fact that Apple's primary trend consistency has been that it has found support in the region of its previous peaks on every one of its significant pullback since 2012 and has just done so again. That is also, I think, confirmatory evidence that some of these companies are capable of still trending in a reasonably consistent manner, even in an environment where only about 7% of all companies are trading below their respective trend means. Trading above their respective trend means. When we then think about the small cap sector, it is certainly where the risks are concentrated, but the quantity of money that is being printed today to support smaller companies is extraordinary in terms of its scale, and it is clearly supporting the small cap sector. So we have the clear potential that it is going to unwind its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. And I think that that is equally true of the European indices. Now, Europe has still got to get its act together in terms of more assistance, and the unanimity with which the Federal Reserve is acting has not been mirrored in the ECB. Christine Lagarde has faced opposition to increasing assistance from the ECB board. But what is likely is that any assistance that some of the most imperiled economies are going to need will be provided to them, regardless of the opposition that might be at least nominally present on the ECB board. They're still going to provide all the assistance that is required to countries like Italy. We can definitely see that in terms of the compression of yields in Italy, and the fact that at one point they were at 3% just 3 weeks ago. Now they're nearly half that level. When we then think about the German 10-year yield, the yield has risen over the course of the last few weeks, and it has sustained those moves, because ultimately there is the clear potential that we are going to see pan-European bonds, not simply, or potentially at least, that any kind of corona bond that is issued on a pan-Europe Eurozone basis will form the first step on the way to a pan-European debt management service, where the debt of all Eurozone nations will be issued from. And the narrowing of spreads is obviously an indication that that is on the way. It is worth reminding ourselves that the reason for the fiscal austerity regime in Europe in the first place was to harmonize debt to GDP ratios across the Eurozone region, with the eventual aim of creating a debt management service. Well, it is increasingly likely that Europe is going to get there by hook or by crook, and this may well be a catalyst for that. The euro has been steadier over the course of the last few sessions. Europe certainly doesn't want a strong currency, but right now the USA is doing more to devalue the dollar. Now, when we look at the pound, it is coming back up towards the 125 area. The UK has been really quite aggressive in putting out assistance, giving money to workers, to small business owners, and promising at least a £600 billion, I'm not sure if it's pounds or dollars, infrastructure fund. And it is that infrastructure component is perhaps one of the other sure things that we can anticipate. Now, we're at a point where we've had a number of problems with aging infrastructure, whether that was the autostrada's collapsing in Italy. There were a number of bridges that were failing during winter floods in the UK last winter. There have been problems with the quality of roads everywhere, and the fact that they were simply not designed to take the traffic that they're currently burdened with. Many internet infrastructure pieces of equipment were not designed to deal with the quantity of traffic they're currently getting with so many people working from home. So that's an additional source of potential infrastructure development. I think ultimately, when we start to think about the fact that one of the reasons why the oil price has been under such extraordinary pressure, and why is it that Saudi Arabia and Russia were not able to come to a supply agreement back at the beginning of the year? It's a clear, I think, a piece of evidence that supports the view we're in a completely different energy environment. And I think when we sort of think about energy, not so much about the supply of energy or the fact that people are worried about the global warming, or whether people are worried about climate change or environmental or social or governance investing. I think one of the most important things written recently was Warren Buffett's recent annual letter, where he talked about the utility that Berkshire Hathaway owns, and that they're able to undercut their competition by nearly 70% because they've invested so heavily in wind. Now, if in a competitive price environment, particularly where the fact that energy prices are low, but that consumers are going to be very reluctant to pay anything extra for their utilities, that if a company can come along and say that if they invest in new infrastructure, that they can reduce the cost of electricity and also help to provide more of it for new industry, then that's a no-brainer. So when we think about what is it that investors are going to want, when we think of what, when we look at everything that's going on in the world, where we have great economic uncertainty, we have companies that are unwilling to offer guidance because they might have some positive view about how things are going to pan out when all the lockdowns end, but they don't know. And we have a lot of money being printed. We have private equity firms that had 1.5 to 2 trillion in dry powder at the beginning of this year. Well, what is it that investors are going to want? In an uncertain environment where the potential for future inflation, or at the very minimum, the devaluation of fiat currencies is going to be a significant issue, then the two things that will offer security to investors will be the security of cash flows, or the ability to act as a safe haven against devaluing currencies. Well, gold is obviously the latter, but the former will be in highly defensive sectors that have either got very long histories of increasing their dividends, or that they have got the security of cash flows offered by utilities. Now, when we think about the oil market, the long-term way of thinking was always that supply was volatile and demand was steady. And the demand growth curve was always predicated on global economic growth, on the rising global population, on improving standards of living for those people, and that as a result of improving standards of living, per capita consumption of energy would increase at a relatively easily predictable growth curve. Whereas supply has always been volatile, whether it was because of geopolitics, because of new discoveries, of old discoveries running dry, of the amount of money that needs to be put in to develop new discoveries and then the lead time to get them to market, supply has always been volatile. Well, what we certainly saw in the bull market for oil prices that peaked back in 2008 through 11 was that massive additional new supplies of oil were discovered and brought to market, and they are now having a significant impact. That's why prices are back in the $20 to $30 region. But this is all happening at a time when China's demand for new motor vehicles is potentially close to a peak. They're not going to get to a per capita ownership of vehicles and miles driven that we have in Europe or particularly in the USA. It's a much more population-dense country, and there just is not enough road to cater to the same number of vehicles per person. And that is equally, if not more so, true in India. It's unlikely India is ever going to get to the number of cars per person that we have in Europe or even in China, simply because it's more people in a smaller region. What we can see certainly in China is that a lot of the infrastructure development is going to go into high voltage cables, it's going to go into renewable energy, and then also into technology. They have seen their the impact that their economy has taken from slowing global economic growth twice in the last 12 years. And they have worked very hard to get their factories back online, and now there are no orders. So the plan in China for the last decade has been to boost the resilience of the domestic economy, and that's going to go into overdrive as a result of the coronavirus. So they're going to double down on investing in infrastructure. And the fact is that with battery technology improving, with solar technology improving, and the cost and efficiency of the wind turbines also improving, the fact that natural gas prices are at historic lows is the seed capital for a new hydrogen sector. So I think these are all involved in the renewable sector. They represent existential threats to the oil sector. This isn't something that's simply going to go away, because they're already competitive in many markets with coal. The better batteries get, the safer they become, the more energy dense they become, the greater the likelihood is we're going to get more battery technology. More battery technology means more energy development. So it's an easy bet to think that the trillions of dollars that are being earmarked globally, whether that is in China or the UK or Europe or the USA, a lot of that is going to get allocated to the renewable energy sector. That's also going to help to placate rest of populations. It's going to answer a long-standing question about energy independence. It's also going to help to improve the balance of payments for a substantial number of consuming nations. It's also going to help to improve the environment overall. One thing I certainly know is that following the fires in Los Angeles back in October, I had a rattling cough for about 5 months, and it's really been the lockdowns and the improving air over the course of the last 3 weeks. My cough has almost completely cleared up, and I live on the west side of Los Angeles, which is generally much less influenced by the smog. So these are, I think, important changes that when we look at what exactly is going to come out of the coronavirus, the lockdowns are likely or have given everybody some experience in working from home. Well, I've been working from home for 13 years already. I really don't ever want to go back and work in an office. I just find the chatting around the water cooler and meetings to be just a complete waste of time. I'm finding myself being much more productive working on my own from home. I think some people will find that they are in the exact same position. Others will find that they need the social interaction, and we're going to get a bifurcation in the workforce. And there will be some jobs that just will never have to go back to the office. That's also going to have an impact on commercial property, and it's not as if commercial property is in a healthy condition already. We're already at a point where there were too many shopping malls had been built, and a significant number of those are going to go bust one way or another. So the retail apocalypse is also going to be accelerated as a result of the coronavirus. We're going to also see people making determinations about what they need and what they don't need, and what they're willing to spend money on and what they're not willing to spend money on. And there is going to be a reevaluation of that as a result of the coronavirus. But it is also worth remembering that human beings are social animals, and we do crave activity, and I think crowds generally. And that is something that is going to recover, although it may take a little while for confidence to improve. The big question then, in the short term, is how long are these lockdowns going to last? We have certainly seen that there's been errors, at the minimum, in testing. One thing that we've seen, for example, in South Korea, which has had the most comprehensive of all testing regimes, is that people who tested negative for 2 days in a row, then tested positive when they were released from quarantine. Now, that raises important questions about the efficacy of the testing regime, and we simply do not know what the error rate is. Is the error rate 1 in 100, or is the error rate 1 in 5? That's a massive question about testing regimes. If I think everyone almost universally agrees that if we want to know how many people have been through the disease, how many people have yet to go through it, what the ramifications are of the lockdowns, well, we can't come up with any kind of conclusive answer until we know how many people have done it. And the only way to do that is with effective testing. And we don't even have effective testing. So that's significant. The primary reason for the lockdowns was to avoid overloading in the hospital setting. Now, with temporary hospitals being set up, with ventilators being bought and being stocked up in hospitals, the overloading seen in Spain and Italy has been avoided in other countries, at least so far. But what we definitely need to see is that these healthcare providers and hospitals can continue to meet the demand. And if that can be determined once lockdowns are gradually loosened, then there's no reason to be locked down. If we have the resources to care for people who are infected, then we don't need to be locked down. Obviously, there is a desire to wait for a vaccine, but a vaccine could take a year. And by the time we get a vaccine, a substantial number of the population will have already had it. And there is a substantial number of people who get the virus and don't even know they've had it. So therefore, we also need antibody testing, but this isn't reliable either. And we still don't have that yet. So it's possible to come up with a rationale for how a lockdown could be withdrawn and reduced and ameliorated, but we're just not there yet. And if China's way of dealing with it is anything to go by, we're not going to be at that point for about another month. And that's a lot of uncertainty. That's a big window for uncertainty. And in that window of time, we're likely to continue to see assistive measures being announced by governments and central banks. It's almost like shock therapy, where the flatlined body is being shocked repeatedly back into activity. Except the only difference is that they are never going to call the deceased. They're simply going to keep shocking it until they get a positive response. And that means that the quantities of money are going to continue to increase. When we look at the total assets of central banks, this is not an index that is updated daily, but when we aggregate them all together, we can see that we're up to 22.5 trillion. So in the last 3 weeks, $3 trillion has been added on to central bank balance sheets. If the dollar continues to decline, this number will go up substantially, considering the fact that it was the strength of the dollar contributed to it going sideways for most of the last 2 years. It wasn't simply that the Federal Reserve had been engaged in quantitative tightening, but rather that the strength of the dollar had devalued the quantity of money sitting on the balance sheets of all other central banks. I think the clear message here is that gold is the best performing asset in the world right now. And it is still an underowned asset, and we are only in the foothills of a bull market. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.